Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. My thanks to Eric Dethridge for holding down the fort these last 3 days, but it's good to be back. In just a moment, Madeline will drop by the Main Street studio. He'll review the movie Snow White. And Dave Thompson, he is our news director here at Prairie Public. He and I will talk about this week's news. And let's begin Main Street today with a Conversations on Healthcare. Hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner talk with Christian Hayden and Alyssa Wasung about how food-based healthcare, like hydroponics and medically tailored meals, is transforming outcomes and cutting costs.
Well, Alyssa and Christian, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark and Margaret. It's such a pleasure to be invited to speak with you and to speak with you as well, Christian.
Thanks for having me.
Many in our audience are familiar with the concept food is medicine. Alyssa and Christian, you may not know, we're part of a community health center network, and one of our founders back in 1960, H. Jack Geiger, was doing a prescription for food and sending those prescriptions to their own pharmacy, which had food. So this is something that's deeply personal to so many of our listeners, and so good to have you. But I'm wondering, Alyssa, if you could give us an overview of the concept as well.
Oh, absolutely. And Dr. Geiger's story is such a famous one. And we also, share that connection to food as medicine as a somewhat ancient concept in some respects that we're kind of coming back around to in this present moment with healthcare. So I'll say a little bit about our coalition and our genesis, which will kind of set the stage, I think, for the current focus on food as medicine. The Food as Medicine Coalition, or FIMIC, is a national coalition of nonprofits that deliver medically tailored meals and groceries alongside medical nutrition therapy and counseling and education to people living in communities across the country who are living with severe, complex, or chronic illnesses. Our goal is to advance access to these life-saving interventions through policy change, research evaluation, and especially as a community of practice through best practices. We offer that community of learning for existing practitioners of food as medicine, and we also train new organizations to launch medically tailored meal programs. A little bit about our history. FIMIC agencies actually created the medically tailored meal intervention, which might be a new term to some, so I will explain it, about 40 years ago as a response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And at that time, there was no treatment for the illness, and people were dying isolated and alone. And so community responded. Volunteers entered people's homes, bringing nourishment in the form of food, really groceries. But they quickly understood that a person who is living with that state of illness actually needs more than just food. They need meals that are tailored to their nutrition needs and their illness to help them stay as healthy as they can be for as long as possible. And registered dietitians were part of this intervention when it was born in this way, and they've been helping us stay current with nutrition science as the intervention evolved through mission expansion, where we now serve people living with all illnesses like cancer, cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney failure, pulmonary issues, musculoskeletal diseases, et cetera. To give you a sense of scale, last year we cooked and home delivered more than 18.9 million meals and equivalents to 64,000 clients across the country. I think it's important to note that we feed people of all ages because illness affects everyone or could affect everyone. And our clients tend to be living with multiple illnesses at once, making their situation quite complex. So we deliver this delicious food to them without fillers, starters, or preservatives. Mm-hmm. And it's important that they eat. So even though our food is medicine, it doesn't taste like that. And we also support the families of our clients as well.
Well, Alyssa, that was a great explanation. Also a very important part of history there that I did not know previously. So thank you so much for sharing that. And Christian, how do you and Levo International bring food as medicine to life through hydroponic farming units?
Yeah, so Levo has been developing an approach to hydroponic farming that's called simplified hydroponics. So simplified hydroponics is growing in, it's same size hydroponics, so it's growing in food, water rather than soil. It's a highly efficient way to grow. It saves about 90% of the water. It uses about a quarter of the space, and it actually grows faster and more per plant than is possible. And so what we've done is we've stripped the complexity out of hydroponic farming. So we developed our technology actually for rural Haitian households. in the Central Plateau of Haiti. It started back in 2016, and we've been developing an approach to make the technology accessible and make, and that's both affordability and simplicity of use and repair. And so we have been developing that and began in 2022 and 2023 to work with St. Francis Hospital, which is part of the Trinity Health Network, as well as Hartford Healthcare, to bring hydroponics into their food as medicine programs. And so the Hartford Healthcare is kind of the big one that we work with. We work with four hospitals now. And the way that we do that is our technology is really straightforward, right? We're talking about PVC, primarily PVC pipes, right? Style of hydroponic farming where plants sit in a PVC pipe and grow out of it. So our methodology, we've really broken it down and made it a science rather than an art form. It reduces the labor requirements as well as the complexity in growing. And so when you go work with a hospital, they have lots of potential volunteer base, like Hartford Hospital has 8,000 employees to draw from for volunteers, but they have a real difficulty in training and in maintaining those spaces and maximizing those spaces that they have in the hospital. So Hartford Hospital, for example, one of our partners, has two rooftops that they've converted into hydroponic farms. And those systems allow for the maximum bang for buck in terms of real estate on the hospital. Those vegetables then go feed into their food for health clinic, which is a very similar kind of a prescription of vegetables. They're referred to clinicians to the food for health clinic. And then some of those vegetables and healthy food options, right? It's not just vegetables. It's the full range of meals are then given to patients who are generally food insecure with a diet-related illness. That's one of the ways that we really work with in the food is medicine space.
Christian, you and I had the opportunity to meet for the first time a number of months ago, and your story and drive are very motivating. And Levo International started when you were told your ideas were, I say, too ambitious. I'm wondering if you could share that story with our listeners.
Sure. So Levo started as my Eagle Scout project originally. It was an extension of my Eagle Scout project. So I had basically discovered about simplified hydroponics and learned about it and wanted to do a project in Haiti. And the Boy Scouts, understandably, looking back, didn't want to sanction a 16-year-old going to Haiti. And so I did my official project for my high school, but then went down with my father and my brother to the Central Plateau in Pion, Haiti, with an organization there. And we built a hydroponic greenhouse for the organization in the Central Plateau. We then realized that, one, a greenhouse in the tropics, it's not a great idea. It's already plenty warm there. But the systems themselves worked, and there was a real opportunity for us to create sustainability in the food system in Haiti, right? Where we can build it out of things that are just locally available, where the average person has to walk a mile to get their water. So traditional agriculture is out of the picture. Hydroponic farming is certainly in the picture. And so we've been developing that, primarily a bucket style hydroponic system in Haiti. And we serve over 400 households with hydroponics continuously, even today, where Haiti is largely collapsed. And that really is the basis of Levo, but we've been developing the same technology, the same basic approach, and stripping out the complexity for the U.S. and around the world.
Well, Alyssa, Christian and Levo International are part of the food as medicine movement that we're seeing and that you just gave us a great explanation about. But maybe pull a couple of threads together for me. I've often heard food as medicine as associated with insurance companies, managed care companies, making sure the patients leaving the hospital get tailored meals. But I've also heard it really as something that primary care providers and healthcare providers in the field are embracing really on more of a teaching basis and educational basis to their patients. So tell me about the whole dimension of food as medicine. I know you can become certified in it as a healthcare provider. So is it happening in lots of different ways, or really does it refer specifically to the medically tailored meals that you're talking about that are delivered to people?
What an excellent question. Food can be medicine along a continuum from prevention to treatment. And so all those wonderful activities that you're talking about come together to make this sort of spectrum or constellation, depending on which way you put it together, a really kind of used rubric for this concept is a pyramid, and it talks about from prevention at the bottom to treatment at the top, really ensuring that people have good nutrition to promote human flourishing and health. And at the bottom, you have access to healthy food, right, in our society, all the way up to when someone has a critical, complex, chronic illness or multiple, utilizing food as treatment. And it is at that top of the pyramid that it's most closely associated with provision through healthcare, whether it be identifying and referring on the provider side or reimbursing and coordinating on the healthcare payer side. So it's like three legs of a stool, right? Community-based interventions, providers identifying folks, and healthcare payers coordinating all of that together. But this intervention actually grew up in community, and it's still very deeply rooted there.
Alyssa, one of the programs that we have as part of our Moses Weitzman Health System is the Weitzman Institute, which is based in Washington, D.C. It's our research institute focused on implementation and improvement science. And so this it's not surprising that we'd want to discuss the research about food as medicine. And you have data that demonstrates that the act of tailoring each meal to meet the client's specific medical diagnosis does work and it saves money. I wonder if you could share a little more about that with our audience.
Absolutely. We've really seen the rise of peer-reviewed research over the last 15 years or so. And it demonstrates, as you just said, unsurprisingly, adding this type of tailored intervention to someone's treatment plan can lower healthcare costs, improve outcomes, and make people happy, which from a mission perspective, from a healthcare systems perspective, is really important and actually measurable in terms of outcomes. And so I think before we start talking about the research, though, it's really important to first ask, what are we testing? A lot of the research I've just mentioned in all detail was done on our agencies. We have about 40 agencies nationwide that are participating in community provision and provision through healthcare. And medically tailored meals is more than just healthy food. Mm-hmm. It is a comprehensive process of delivering a tailored intervention. So a person is referred to a community-based organization by a healthcare professional. They're then assessed by a registered dietitian nutritionist or a nutrition professional, and together they're creating a meal plan that satisfies the needs of the person in terms of tastes, right? We're not going to send someone fish if they don't like fish, but also encapsulates that layering of restrictions that must be accomplished so that people can experience those outcomes. And then after it's cooked and delivered, folks experience ongoing nutrition counseling and education. So we're really following someone through the trajectory of their illness. That is the intervention that produces outcomes like reducing hospitalizations by 50% or decreasing ER utilizations by 70%. And those are very costly healthcare interventions that are necessary sometimes, but are avoidable at other times. And these types of overall healthcare cost reduction amount to about 16% net in some of the studies that have been done on medically tailored meals. So that means inclusive of the cost of these very highly tailored meals. There are also other benefits to medically tailored meals, like improved mental health or better diabetes management if one has diabetes, healthier eating habits, and unsurprisingly, reduced food insecurity, which in and of itself promotes health, as many other research studies have shown. So the literature is growing. It seems like almost every week there is a new food as medicine study coming out. There are also some really big research vehicles and projects that are field-wide that have been put in place with this new focus on food as medicine.
Well, Christian, you're partnering with a growing network of food as medicine partners, as we've just heard about, and that includes hospitals that are increasingly providing free prescriptions of healthy food and recipes. In fact, here in Connecticut, and this was kind of news to me recently, Hartford Hospital's hydroponic rooftop farm in 2023 was the first of its kind in the United States at a hospital. So I'm proud of that here in Connecticut. Are you seeing the types of outcomes that Alyssa talked about with the hydroponic rooftop at Hartford Hospital as part of the picture?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I think that is something that we know, right? And I'm sure Alyssa can talk to this, but being involved in the food process, right? Seeing how food is produced, a lot of people, particularly from poverty, right, have never been to a farm. They've never seen where vegetables, they just appear at the store shelves. They may be really poor taste. They may be really poor quality. And, you know, everybody will tell you, right? You go to a grocery store and you buy a tomato, right? Generally, that tomato is pretty poor. Versus if you grow in your backyard, that tomato has a whole different taste profile. And so we have been able to provide the hospital with a means to excite their patients, right? The way they specifically request the rooftop vegetables, right? And they go up and they get to see the plants growing and engage with that. And that we build that into our educational programming that we do, not just at the hospital, but around the state, right? You get young people involved in the growing of vegetables and the consumption, and therefore they are more likely to consume them. And so, you know, it really is an exciting add-on to the program. I mean, at the scale, we're actively working to scale up our production so we can contribute to more and more and more of the amount of vegetables and the amount of food that is given out by the clinic. But it's a really exciting component that they build in the community education and community interaction with the food itself. And it's exciting to be a part of it. And you know, just adding on talking about cost savings. I mean, the case studies that we're seeing out of the Food for Health Clinic at Hartford Hospital are remarkable. I mean, people not needing heart transplants, right? Which is a multi-million dollar surgery that now, just because of diet, they no longer need major surgery that costs millions of dollars. And so it's a really exciting thing to be a part of, just because of all of the different benefits that you get to see relatively quickly. In the people that we're working with.
And just to build on what Christian just said, actually, researchers at Tufts Friedman took a lot of the medically tailored meal research and asked the question, what savings could we expect as a country if we, you know, modeled this research nationally? And they found that if every eligible patient actually received medically tailored meals, again, we're talking high risk, high need patients at the top of the pyramid, but that our nation could save $13.6 billion with a B dollars in 1 year. And that's net of the cost of meals. So this is a tremendous opportunity to build a more efficient and effective healthcare system and reconnect people back to their communities and back to some of what Christian was talking about, the experience of eating.
Well, we always like to say building an efficient, effective, elegant, and economical system is so important. And I think about it in terms of the lens of a provider. I'm wondering, you've given a list of good outcomes. What about in terms of patient satisfaction? What do we hear in terms of what's the feedback providers are getting from their patients?
I mean, there are ways of measuring satisfaction, of course, with validated tools and such. But for me, it's the stories, right? People avoiding amputations, people being able to participate in activities with their grandkids, people avoiding, as Christian said, you know, needing to have transplants or other serious medical issues are avoided in their lives. And also the, you know, for us as community-based, mission-oriented agencies, it is that connection to community, knowing that volunteers chop the carrots that are in the meal that you're eating. People feel the love. People feel that connection in terms of satisfaction. So for us, it's kind of a full circle where you have the measured outcomes of, you know, being and feeling healthier and how that makes you feel as a human, measured in research and in stories, but also that connection to community that we do believe is part of that healing.
I think what's exciting about the food is medicine concept in general is it a lot of times medicine can feel for the patients is really impersonal. And the things like medically tailored meals and involving them in the actual food production, it removes that, adds a personal layer, and makes people feel like they're part of their health, right? Improving. It's not just a medicine regime they have to take, right? Or a treatment that they have to take. It's food. It's the, you know, one of the best things about the day is your meal, right? And so it's an elegant, right, Mark, going off what you're saying, way to really engage people in being healthy and improving their lives.
This focus on extremely healthy and maybe even medically tailored, if you think of children as growing little people and certainly pregnancy, are also priorities. What's going on in that space relative to food is medicine?
Well, I think I would say first just that the whole nexus to healthcare, you know, doctors are some of our biggest champions because they're seeing this in their patients every day. But healthcare insurers are also big champions. And so, you know, while we are really, you know, focused on the populations that I've indicated when it comes to research, the populations are expanding. Like many of our agencies actually have medically tailored meal programs for pregnant people who are experiencing gestational diabetes or looking at the first 1,000 days of a human's life, right? There are some wonderful medically tailored meal and medically tailored food programs across the country focusing on children and childhood obesity. So we're seeing the circles start to kind of go out from, you know, the focus on avoiding high cost procedures and helping to stabilize people in their homes where they want to be as well. And I would say all of this research has really been the catalyst for states and healthcare plans to leverage these interventions in their flexibilities in their state to provide it through health insurance. For medically tailored meals specifically, Medicaid has been really one of the primary sources of new cost-effective policies for coverage of food as medicine interventions. And for those of you for whom Medicaid and Medicare can get confusing, it can. Medicaid is the public insurance infrastructure for low-income Americans. And to date, 13 states have passed waivers that include food as medicine or food as medicine adjacent services in their state Medicaid programs, and 3 are pending. There's also legislation. There are other flexibilities that states can draw on, and they're doing it, and it's a whole range of states. And North Carolina is actually a really great example. They piloted in several counties at first, and now are expanding those counties because it was so successful. So I think, you know, being able to tailor an intervention for your state, locality, and then being able to build upon that has just really been a tremendous engine for answering state-based needs.
That's great. And maybe a question to both of you. You are both part of the next generation of leaders. And I'm wondering if you think your drive and energy are an indication that your generation is more willing to embrace the ideas more than others have in the past.
What's great about food as medicine is it makes sense. And it doesn't just make sense to a younger generation bringing in energy. It makes sense to everybody. And I think that's what makes it so compelling and exciting for all of us involved in the space, you know, young and old, right, is that this is something that's very clear, right? There's a fundamental understanding, even without the research, where you're like, of course, right? One of the major problems that we have in society for our healthcare sector, right, and health is food, right? We know we're not eating healthy in America in general. And so what's exciting is there's now research and there's now energy behind it. And so what I find most exciting is not just people my age or close to my age, is that everybody in this space is we're building momentum. It's not just the young people that are going to save the American healthcare. So it's everybody. We're all involved in it, right? We're even sitting on this podcast and talking about it, right? The energy is there, and it's there across generations, I think is what I would say. And it's exciting to be a part of.
So my final question, what if somebody wants to start somewhere with hydroponics on their own? Maybe not a whole farm or a rooftop garden. Is this accessible for somebody to do in a residential setting?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's what we specialize in is anything from farming to kind of the DIY, do it yourself at home. And I would encourage anyone to go to loveointernational.org and reach out if they're interested in hydroponics.
I do feel this tremendous energy and growth of interest in food as medicine. It is bipartisan. It is cross-generation. It is an acknowledgement, I think, about the high cost of healthcare not actually resulting in the health that we're all looking for. The research combined, also the experience of, you know, the pandemic when food supply lines were cut and we needed to meet people in their homes. So this renewed interest just brings a lot of energy, I think, to the conversation. And we're seeing multiple sectors get involved, right? We just talked about all of the different actors in this field. And so with all of this interest, I do think that it is also important to, you know, have the conversations about what are we talking about to ensure that, you know, as we bring this intervention or these interventions that grew up in community into the healthcare sector, we're ensuring that we're retaining the rigor and the connection to community, because those are the things that actually produce those good outcomes. We are working on that in a variety of different ways. Last year, we actually put out the first standard for the intervention. I can hear Christian's commitment to how hydroponics is executed. These are good conversations to have so that we are ensuring that, you know, we're not testing subpar interventions that don't result in good outcomes and then abandoning the whole project. So I think there is another kind of call to recommit to those things and to have those conversations and those educational moments
too. Well, it's wonderful to hear bipartisan and multi-generational. That is the prescription for everyone to come together. I want to thank Alyssa and Christian. Thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube and find us on Facebook. And you can also share your thoughts and comments about this program. Take care and be well.
Coming up on Main Street, Dave Thompson and I review this week's North Dakota news, and Matt Olean reviews the movie Snow White. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
Thompson now joins us again here on Main Street. Dave and I review the news every Thursday. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig, and yourself?
I'm doing well, Dave. Thank you so much. Let's get right to it. Dave, the legislature wants to raise the vote needed to amend the state constitution. I think I saw this coming.
We all did. And this has been an argument that legislators have been proposing for several sessions, that it's too easy to amend the North Dakota Constitution because our vote to amend is 50% plus one vote. They want to raise it to 60% plus one vote, and they say it should be harder to change the Constitution than it is to pass a bill. So they've got that one to go to 60% plus one vote, but there's some pushback from some people who like to, you know, circulate petitions and put things on the ballot from the public's perspective. And here's a little irony for you, is that a bill that would constitutional amendments of 60% plus one vote can be approved next year by 50% plus one vote.
The ways laws work. Never ceases to surprise me, Dave. Yeah. There's been a new CEO named for the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. This is kind of a big thing.
It is. Clarence Sitter becomes, I think, only the third in its history. You know, Randy Hotzenbuehler, who had been doing it for a number of years, did some very good things to improve Medora, did some improvements to the musical, improvements to some of the downtown amenities, and was, you know, kind of there out front saying, you know, Medora is a destination place. So it has become a real destination place for people in North Dakota and people from the upper Midwest, they go. And now you got the 60th anniversary of the Medora musical this year. And then, of course, what's happening next year is you've got the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Library, which will probably enhance tourism even more.
Certainly make it even more of a year-round destination.
Absolutely. And to prepare, they're building a new 100-room hotel in Medora.
Dave, a prior authorization reform bill has now passed the North Dakota legislature. This makes sense.
It does make sense because if you don't know what prior authorization is, it basically doctors going to propose you having some kind of medical procedure, but the insurance company has to say, I'm going to pay for it. So that's the prior authorization. Now they're saying that they're not going to ban insurance companies from denying some prior authorization, but they want to tighten up the procedure. And what they mean is that if an insurance company will deny it, then you have to have a doctor who's in that specialty actually do the denying, except for sometimes insurance companies have used people from accounting and things like that to deny it. You know, more patient rights.
It's always been a thorn in my side that some bean counter thinks he knows more than my doctor.
That's
correct. I hope this moves forward. Dave, the Keystone Pipeline has shut down now after a leak in North Dakota.
It's really interesting that was reported Tuesday. There was a drop in pressure of the line, and then the people who monitor looked out and they saw the oil shooting out of the line. They got it shut down in just a couple of minutes. Good for them, but still some oil spilled. Now, this Keystone has had a few spills, and you know, it hasn't been an emergency situation, but there's some cleanup involved. So there will be some hue and cry about that and pipeline safety.
And the big hope is this doesn't enter into any water supply.
Yeah, they say they've got it contained on farmland, and a creek that is nearby is protected. Of course, I'm worried, you know, this is near Catherine, North Dakota, and the Cheyenne River is in that area. So you're always worried about that.
Dave, there's a mask bill now that has passed the Senate. The legislature is concerned that people are hiding their identity, even maybe while protesting.
That's correct. Now, this is not the masks like we put on during COVID. There are people who are going to some of the protests, and they've got their heads covered or, you know, a hood over their head, and they want to basically be anonymous. So the bill would say if you get caught, well, you can undergo some criminal charges. So that's interesting. There's a lot of support for this because of a growing concern among law enforcement about these kinds of protests.
Dave, you're doing some traveling this weekend. Where are you headed?
I am heading to Minneapolis for the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association. I've been on that board for about 25 years. I've served as president of the organization twice. This is our annual get-together where we, you know, seminars and training and also awards. And we're up for some awards. We'll see what happens.
Dave, it's always a pleasure. Have a good weekend and travel safe.
Thank you, Craig. You have a good one.
There's the fanfare we look forward to each and every Thursday here on Main Street. It means one thing, and that's that Madeline has graced our Main Street studio. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Craig.
Today we're having you review for us Snow White. Let's listen to the trailer.
This was my father's kingdom, a place of fairness. But the queen changed everything.
Take him away,
Your Majesty.
What did you say?
The people need some kindness.
You know, I really don't remember you being this opinionated.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest of them all?
Famed is thy beauty, Majesty. But the lovely maiden I now behold.
I look at you, and I just want to be the fairest of them all.
The queen is evil. You must flee into the woods.
Matt, as we come out of the trailer there, I always wonder if it's good to mess with stuff that was great already at one time. What do you think of Snow White?
I agree with you, Craig. I am not a fan of the Disney live-action remakes that have just been out of control lately. I mean, I don't need to see a Mufasa live-action with CGI, you know, lions and whatnot. And I certainly didn't need to see another Snow White, even though obviously we need to review something, right? So here we are. This production, as you might know, Craig, I know because I kind of follow this stuff, has been fraught with problems from the beginning.
Controversy.
Controversy has followed this production for 4 years, basically. There were reshoots last year because the first cut was not acceptable. Some of the scenes look darker than other scenes, and it doesn't seem to fit right with these reshoots. Yes, fraught with controversy from the beginning with should they remake this 1937 masterpiece, which is still, I think, an animated masterpiece to this day. Certainly some of the themes of the original maybe have dated a little bit in 88 years. And then the casting, right? Rachel Zegler as Snow White, it has been, you know, debated and kicked around for 2 years since she was announced as Snow White. She is of Latino descent. She was in West Side Story. She's very talented. And let me say right now, whatever issues people had with her being cast as Snow White, she does her best in this role. She sings, she dances, she's very talented. She, you know, she pops off the screen. She was really good as Maria in West Side Story. So I don't think the reason this film has made less than $100 million domestic already, which is low for a film like this, is Rachel Zegler's fault. I do think a lot of the off-screen controversies from things like Rachel Zegler talking about the Israel-Gaza war, Gal Gadot, same thing as the Evil Queen. Gal Gadot is Israeli. And her and Rachel Zegler have had disagreements on the Israel-Gaza war, as if that should have anything to do with this movie, right? Because politics enters all of our daily lives. And this has been another issue off screen that Disney's had to deal with, is the Zegler-Gal Gadot thing. But I think the reason the film doesn't work, and look, it's not quite as bad as you might imagine it to be, Craig, once I saw it. Some of the old songs are still there. Hi-Ho, Hi-Ho is still in there, the song by the Dwarfs. Whistle While You Work is still in there, and there's some new songs as well. Mark Webb is the director. He's actually got a pretty good track record. He directed a couple of the Amazing Spider-Man films with Andrew Garfield. He directed 500 Days of Summer, which is actually a very good film. But here, you know, he's directing a product. He's directing a Disney product, and he's at the behest of Disney. He's got off-screen controversies and a couple of things that really, I think, make this film go off the rails. Number one is the casting of Gal Gadot as the Evil Queen. She's bad. She's awful. She's miscast. It doesn't work. I don't know what is wrong with this. They have a singing and dancing number with her as well, which is laughable to the point of that I'm laughing, right? I laughed when I watched the number. The Evil Queen singing and dancing. Gal Gadot is not a singer, and she's not good as the Evil Queen. It's bad casting. I don't know if it's her accent or whatever's going on. She just is not, she's not good as the Evil Queen. Rachel Zegler does her best. I think Andrew Burnap does his best as Jonathan. He's this rebel who is Snow White's true love. And then finally, the decision to reimagine the dwarfs, or little people, whatever. Little person is the accepted term in society now to talk about people in the dwarfism community. They went CGI in the dwarfs. So Snow White, you know, there's Rachel Zegler as Snow White, you know, whistling while she works, and the dwarves are CGI. Initially, Disney wanted to cast 7 actors in the little person community. I'm using the word little person, the dwarfism community, and Peter Dinklage, who's clearly the most famous little person actor out there, objected, even though he wouldn't have been in the film anyway. Well, Peter Dinklage doesn't need the money, but other actors of smaller stature might have been interested in those roles. And I've heard a lot of pushback from actors in the community saying these should have been played by real people. And I agree. Once I saw the film, they should have just done a lot of really great makeup to make, you know, a little person look like, little person actor look like dopey or happy or grumpy. Instead, they CGI the dwarfs. And of course, that's the original title of the Grimm fairy tale, is Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. So the CGI doesn't work. It's weird. It's creepy. She's hanging out with the CGI dwarves, and it just doesn't work. I think it would have been better to go with real people in those roles. I think that was a mistake as well, among several mistakes. The film is not making the money that they thought it would. I think some of the off-screen controversy has nicked it at the box office. I was the only person in the theater when I saw this at 5:30 on a Monday night earlier this week. I don't know if it's a full-fledged disaster, but the dwarves should not have been CGI'd, and Gal Gadot is not good as the Evil Queen. Zegler, it's really not Rachel Zegler's fault, I don't think.
You know, when you look at a movie like this, it just seems to me that this is almost money-grabbing nostalgia, some of these live remakes that they try to do. It's just like, all right, let's squeeze the turnip here, see what we can get out of the picture. And boy, this sure rings in that category for me.
There's no question, Craig. It's a money grab. That's what Disney does. And I think they just need to, you know, just have new films, right, with new screenplays. And, of course, their association with Pixar has been very successful. And we've had some great films coming out of Disney Pixar, like Inside Out and, you know, so many others over the years. This isn't one of them. It's a money grab. Snow White is a crucial property for Disney. It's the first full-length animated film ever made. It's, for a lot of us, it was the first, you know, feature film we ever saw, because they would re-release it in theaters. And it's still amazing to watch. It really is. I think the animation still works on a lot of levels. But remaking it, you know, I get it, updating some of the themes in this film. Snow White is more of an action hero. She's not a passive person who, you know, who needs that kiss from the Prince Charming type person. She definitely, there's scenes with her helping out the rebels to fight back against the Queen's guards. And I'm fine with all that. You know, some updating of that is completely okay. And like I said, it's a money grab. But I think it's too short-sighted to just blame Rachel Zegler and the casting of this film. There's a lot of other problems going on.
Before we go to the Oscar trivia part of the show, Matt, did it surprise you last week how great a Minecraft movie did at the box office?
Yes, I was completely stunned by that $140 or $50 million opening. Look, it's not something I'd be interested in, but my son used to play Minecraft, and it remains a very, very popular, maybe the most popular video game of all time. Yeah, it's doing great, and it got kids into the theaters more than Snow White did. So good for them. I probably won't see it. Yeah, I was very that overperformed, and Snow White has underperformed at the box office.
All right, now for Oscar trivia, Matt. Snow White is not an animated film, but it leads to the question, has an animated film ever won an Oscar for Best Picture?
No.
And you've named one of them. Name two others that have been nominated. You've talked about Up.
Yeah, Beauty and the Beast and Toy Story 3 were also nominated for Best Picture.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
You've spent years building a career, raising a family, chasing what society says success looks like. But now the kids are grown, their promotion is yours, and you're left wondering what's next. This May, Humanities North Dakota presents How Much Is Enough with Kay Hee. After 15 years on Wall Street, Kay discovered achieving all the right things didn't feel right. Learn how to stop chasing and start living with clarity and purpose. More information can be found online at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As climate change makes sea ice less reliable, salmon and humpback whales might become more common in the Arctic. As the Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden reports on how that change could impact subsistence lifestyles and what scientists have to say about it.
Catching salmon in the North Slope village of Kaktovik was unheard of not too long ago. But as resident Robert Thompson says, some fishermen now see salmon more regularly. About 5 years ago, Thompson caught a dozen salmon, a small but noticeable number, he says.
Before, it was unusual and people would talk about it, like if somebody got a salmon, but now it's fairly common, but not like many, many, many.
Fishermen, hunters, and researchers gathered at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage back in January to discuss changing migration patterns of several fish species and marine animals. That includes humpbacks, who seem to be gaining new ground up north, bowheads expanding their diet, and salmon observed in the Arctic. One of the conference presenters was Elizabeth Mika-Clindley, a graduate student from Bethel who grew up fishing for salmon. For a year, Lindley and other researchers tracked temperatures in the Anaktuvik River, which runs through gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. They saw that water at the depth of salmon nests never got below freezing. They also estimated that salmon emerged around August, which is later than in other parts of the state, but the optimal time for the Arctic.
The temperature conditions, it seems like they are survivable, and it does seem like they would allow for development to occur with enough time for them to hatch and emerge into the stream.
The warming environment has also been affecting bowhead whales. The animals have been delaying their migration to the Bering Sea or even staying in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas for the winter. Marine ecologist Clarissa Teixeira says the makeup of the whales' baleen plates can offer a window into their diet and movements. Teixeira sampled baleen plates from 11 bowheads and looked at the ice conditions during the years they were harvested. She discovered that after 2016, when the ice conditions were extremely low, bowheads expanded their foraging habitats or fed on wider composition of prey. She shared her discovery during the conference.
And that's amazing because it shows how resilient these individuals are, right?
Less ice might also mean new territory for humpback whales. Oceanographer Kate Stafford says data from local whalers and aerial surveys points to more humpbacks visiting the Chukchi Sea in recent years. In Utqiagvik, humpbacks were sighted only twice before 2021 and two to three times in years after that. Then, last fall, researchers saw more than 25 whales feeding close together for 2 days in a row.
We came across what I would call humpback palooza.
Stafford says that young humpbacks usually follow the migration patterns they learn from their mothers. Since researchers observed multiple mother-calf pairs, the whales might return to the area.
This does suggest, at least to me, that humpbacks are here to stay near Utqiagvik, at least so long as there's something to eat.
Scientists like Stafford rely on help from indigenous knowledge holders, hunters, and whalers for their research.
They're really good naturalists. They're really good observers and biologists because they need to understand the seasonality of animals, the behavior of animals, how the environment impacts animals. And so I really rely so much on their feedback and input.
Utqiagvik whaler Michael Donovan says he did not witness the humpback palooza, but he has seen a few humpbacks during his fall hunts.
We did spot a few out there while hunting, but we didn't see the large numbers like the researchers did.
He says that he and other whalers are worried that humpbacks might be competing for krill and copepods with bowheads, the staple subsistence resource in his community.
Well, definitely they're an invasive species. You know, they come in and eat the same food that our bowheads eat.
Donovan and other hunters say they're supportive of scientists collecting data on whales other than bowheads, which are growing their presence in warming waters in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 11th. It wouldn't be so bad if it weren't for the wind. Many a North Dakotan has lamented the state's well-known whirlwinds, and for good reason. North Dakota is relatively flat with few natural formations to block the wind. So it's no surprise that the weather has been a topic of interest in newspapers since the region became a state. On this date, in 1907, it was reported that winds were strong enough to tear apart a railroad windmill in Hazleton, North Dakota. A few months later, a great windstorm struck Williston. The Williston Graphic reported winds strong enough to sweep the wood from buildings into the sky. Many homes were destroyed, and several people were injured, including one man who lost his life. In addition to the destruction of buildings and human injury, the wind blew the roof off the city's electric station, leaving many without power for several days. While most people, rightfully, see the wind as a nuisance, some have seen its potential for energy production. In a 1912 article, a local Grand Forks professor, A.H. Taylor, proposed the idea of wind-generated energy. He appealed to farmers across the state, promising electric light, heat, and power from wind energy alone. His plan was to use ordinary windmills, modified to generate energy that would then be stored in Edison batteries, which had recently gained traction across the United States. Company manager of the Edison battery took a keen interest in the project, predicting that the battery would work well with proper modifications to meet the electrical input needs of the windmills. With this reassurance, the professor saw the potential for isolated communities across North Dakota to benefit from these new inventions and the state's natural wind resources. Wind energy has remained a topic of interest in the state to this day. Industrial windmills, far larger than Professor Taylor ever imagined, can be seen by travelers crossing the state. As of 2023, the energy generated from these windmills accounts for 36% of North Dakota's energy production, the sixth highest percentage of wind-produced energy in the country. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Olivia Burmeister. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. The topic, Trump's first 100 days. What do you think so far? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. That's one of my favorite shows here on Prairie Public. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday right back here on Main Street.